half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction.
This is Michael Hansen. Welcome to another edition of Mind Webs. This story, Monkey and the Lady, is by Neil Gaiman. Copyright 2017. Monkey was in the plum tree. He had only made the universe that morning, and he had been admiring it, particularly the moon, which was visible in the daytime sky from the top of the tree. He had made the winds and the stars, the ocean waves, and the towering cliffs. He had made fruit to eat, and he had been enthusiastically picking and eating fruit all day, and trees to climb, and from which he could observe the world he had made. Now, he was covered in sticky red juice. He laughed with delight, because it was a good world, and the plums were sweet and tart and sun-warmed, and it was good to be monkey. Something was walking beneath the tree, something he did not remember having created. It was walking in a stately fashion, looking at the flowers and the plants. Monkey dropped a half-eaten plum onto it to see what it would do. It picked the plum from its shoulder and flicked the fruit uneaten into the bushes. Monkey dropped to the ground.
"Hello," said Monkey.
"You must be Monkey,"
said the person. She wore a high-collared blouse, and her gray skirts were full and went almost to the ground. She even wore a hat with a rose of a dusty orange color tucked into the hatband.
"Yes," said Monkey, and he scratched himself with his left foot. "Yes, I made all this."
"I am the lady,"
said the woman.
"I believe we're going to have to learn to live together."
"I don't remember making you," said Monkey, puzzled. "I made fruit and trees and ponds and sticks and..."
"You certainly didn't make me,"
said the woman. Monkey scratched himself thoughtfully, this time with his right foot. Then he picked up a plum from the ground, devoured it with relish, and threw the plum stone down when he was done. He picked at the mushy remains of plum from the fur on the back of his arm and sucked at the fruit he retrieved.
"Is that really acceptable behavior?"
"I'm Monkey, and I do whatever I want to."
"I'm sure you do, but not if you wish to be with me."
Monkey pondered.
"Do I wish to be with you?"
The lady looked at Monkey gravely, and she smiled. It was the smile that did it. Somewhere between the beginning of the smile and the end of it, Monkey decided that spending time in this person's company would be a fine thing. Monkey nodded.
"In which case, you will need clothes, and you will need manners, and you will need not to do that."
"What?"
"The thing you are doing with your hands."
Monkey looked at his hands guiltily. He was not quite certain what they had been doing. Monkey's hands were part of him, he knew. But when he was not actually thinking about them, they did whatever hands did when you were not watching them. They scratched and they investigated and they poked and they touched. They picked insects from crevices and pulled nuts from bushes. "Behave yourselves," Monkey thought at his hands. In reply, one of the hands began to pick at the fingernails of the other. This would not be easy, he decided, not even a little. Making stars and trees and volcanoes and thunderclouds was easier. But it would be worth it. He was almost certain it would be worth it. Monkey had created everything, so he intuited immediately what clothes were, cloth coverings that people would wear. In order for clothes to exist, he needed to make people to wear them, to exchange them, and to sell them. So he created a nearby village in which there would be clothes, and he filled it with people. He created a little street market and people who would sell things in the market. He created food stalls where people made food that sizzled and smelled enticing, and stalls that sold strings of shells and beads. Monkey saw some clothes on a market stall. They were colorful and strange, and Monkey liked the look of them immediately. He waited until the stallholder's back was turned, and then he swung down and seized the clothes and ran through the market while people shouted at him in anger or in amusement. He put the clothes on, just as humans wore them, and then awkwardly he went and found the lady. She was in a small cafe near the market.
"It's me," said Monkey.
The lady examined him without approaching. Then she sighed.
"It is you, and you are wearing clothes. They are very gaudy, but they are clothes."
Shall we live together now?" said Monkey.
In response, the lady passed Monkey a plate with a cucumber sandwich on it. Monkey took a bite of the sandwich, broke the plate experimentally on a rock, cut himself on a section of broken plate, then peeled apart the sandwich, picked the cucumber from it with bloody fingers, and threw the remaining bread onto the cafe floor.
"You will need to do a better impersonation of a person than that,"
said the lady. And she walked away in her gray leather shoes with buttons up the side.
"I created all the people," thought Monkey. "I created them as gray, dull, land-bound things to make Monkey seem wiser and funnier and freer and more alive. Why should I now pretend to be one?"
But he said nothing. He spent the next day and the day after that watching people and following them on the earth, almost never climbing walls or trees or flinging himself upwards or across spaces only to catch himself before he fell. He pretended that he was not Monkey. He decided not to answer to Monkey anymore when anything spoke to him. From now on, he told them, he was Man. He moved awkwardly on the earth. He only managed to conquer the urge to climb everything once he stole shoes and forced them onto his feet, which were not made for shoes. He hid his tail inside his trousers, and now he could only touch the world and move it or change it with his hands or his teeth. Monkey's hands were better behaved, too, more responsible now that his tail and his feet were hidden, less likely to poke or pry, to rip or to rub. The lady was drinking tea in a small cafe near the market, and he sat beside her.
"Sit on the chair, not the table."
Monkey was not sure he would always be able to tell the difference, but he did as she requested.
"Well,"
said Monkey.
"You're getting there. Now you just need a job."
Monkey frowned and chittered,
"A job?"
He knew what a job was, of course, because Monkey had created jobs when he had created everything else. Rainbows and nebulae and plums and all the things in the oceans. But he had barely paid attention to them, even as he created them. They were a joke, something for Monkey and his friends to laugh at.
"A job?" repeated Monkey. "A job? You want me to stop eating whenever I wish and whatever I wish and living where I wish and sleeping where I wish, and instead to go to work in the morning and come home tired in the evening, earning money enough to buy food to eat and a place to live and to sleep?"
"A job. Now you're getting the idea."
Monkey went into the village he had made, but there were no jobs there to be had, and the people laughed at him when he asked them to employ him. He went into a town nearby and found himself a job, sitting at a desk and writing lists of names into a huge ledger bigger than he was. He did not enjoy sitting at the desk and writing names. It made his hands hurt, and whenever he sucked absent-mindedly on his pen and thought of the forests, the blue ink tasted foul and left ink stains on his face and his fingers. On the last day of the week, Monkey took his pay and walked from the town back to the village where he had last seen the lady. His shoes were dusty and they hurt his feet. He put one foot in front of the other on the path. Monkey went to the cafe, but it was empty. He asked if anyone there had seen the lady. The owner shrugged her shoulders, but said that on reflection she thought she had seen the lady in the rose garden on the edge of the village the previous day, and perhaps Monkey should look there.
"Man,"
corrected Monkey.
"Not Monkey."
But his heart was not in it. Monkey went to the rose gardens, but he did not see the lady. He was slouching along the path that would have taken him back to the cafe when he noticed something on the dry earth. It was a gray hat with a dusty orange rose in the hat band. Monkey walked towards the hat and picked it up and examined it to see if perhaps the lady was underneath it. She was not. But Monkey noticed something else a minute's walk away. He hurried over to it. It was a gray shoe with buttons up the side. He walked on in the same direction, and there, on the ground, was a second shoe, almost the twin of the first. Monkey kept going now. Soon, crumpled on the side of the road, he found a woman's jacket, and then he found a blouse. He found a skirt, abandoned on the edge of the village. Outside the village, he found more gray clothes, thin and unlikely, like the shed skins of some scanty reptile hanging now from branches. The sun would soon be setting, and the moon was already high in the eastern sky. Something about the branches the clothes were hanging on felt familiar. He walked further into the grove of trees. Something hit Monkey on the shoulder. It was a half-eaten plum. Monkey looked up. She was far above him, naked and hairy-arsed, her face and her breast stained and sticky with red juice, sitting and laughing in the plum tree.
"Come and look at the moon,"
she said with delight.
"Come and look at the moon with me."
That story is titled Monkey and the Lady, written by Neil Gaiman. Reading with me was Sarah Settler. The story comes from the volume The Weight of Words, edited by Dave McKean and William Schaefer, and copyright 2017 by the Subterranean Press. MindWebs continues now with a story written by Peter Carter. This is The Mist. Copyright 1952 by Fantasy House. The little man on the porch was trembling as he leaned forward, trying to catch the words above the noise of the hounds baying in the side yard. His small, alert face was pale, drawn, his eyes too eager. He gave the appearance of being smaller somehow than he should be, as though he were shrunken. His clothes hung on him too large. His eyes were tired, lost-looking.
Mr. Brown, please listen. If this is real, this time not a rumor, please.
Brown shook his head slowly, his eyes careful.
But it's what I've searched for, Mr. Brown. You've seen it. Others have. You've sworn to the truth of it.
Sure. Brown spat, nodded his head.
Sure. And then, well, then it says we ain't our liars, for sure. I know, Mr. Brown. I'm an investigator of psychic phenomena, of ghosts and things. I must see that apparition tonight.
The shrunken man closed his eyes for an instant, leaned against the porch post.
Saturday night.
But, Mr. Brown, this will be the last night.
Might be right along now, I don't know.
I know, Mr. Brown.
The little man rubbed at his finger with the big golden ring on it.
I know. Another 10 minutes at the most, and I've got to...
He stopped, let his eyes beg for him.
Well, I reckon it's worth looking at right enough.
You're sure what it looks like?
I know what I've seen, golden and glowing it is. You gotta have dark to see it real dark. It don't move exactly, just stays still, but sort of shimmies like.
That's it, Mr. Brown. I've got to see it.
Well, reckon that's out, mister. I'm going to town.
Brown watched the little man's eyes, saw the pain in them.
Of course, if it's worth something, reckon it'd have to be for me to stay home Saturday night.
It would take a minute, a moment.
I gotta be getting along.
It's worth everything to me, Mr. Brown. Everything.
Well, how much?
I don't have money.
What?
I begged rides for 700 miles to get here.
Brown shook his head.
Nice ring you got. Well, I really gotta be getting to town.
The little man dropped his hand to his side, then he raised it again. His eyes, too, moved to the curiously shaped ring on his finger.
I can't let you have that.
Brown shrugged his big shoulders, stepped back, and fingered the inside doorknob.
Well, I gotta lock up now and let out the hounds. Don't be hanging around the yard when I let out the hounds.
No, wait. You can have the ring.
Brown closed his eyes.
I don't know.
You can have it?
The big man opened the screen door, took the ring. He stepped back so the little man could come through the doorway. Brown struck a match, lit the lamp on the table, and turned the ring over and over very slowly in his thick fingers. His eyes squinted shrewdly. Golden, but not gold. Too heavy for gold or any other metal. Much too large for the little man's fingers. Brown pushed it on his last finger, felt it grip the flesh. The little man, moving nervously, found the bedroom door.
Brown gave him a rough shove. Go ahead, you paid, and it ain't nothing to hurt a man.
But the little man stood aside, let Brown lead the way. It was a golden blot in the air, shimmering in the center of the bedroom. 8 feet high, perhaps, and about 4 wide. Brown laughed coarsely.
Not a spook, is it, mister? I know it wasn't. Reckon you was paying for a spook. Of course, I didn't say it was a spook.
The little man's face hardened. He looked at Brown appraisingly, sadly, then he shrugged.
I can't quite believe you really walked through that, Brown.
Sure. Well, sure I did. Watch.
Wait. I'll walk with you. Wait.
The little man stepped forward. Then, as though still uncertain, put his fingers on Brown's arm.
All right.
Together, they moved forward into the golden mist. It was different for the big man this time. As they entered the mist, he felt sharp tingles dance over his skin. Before, there had been nothing but the feel of air. He started to step back, was stopped by surprising strength from the little man. Brown was forced forward. The tingling was almost unbearable. It seemed to come in hot flashes now, from the finger that wore the ring. Brown hurried, trying to get back to the familiar bedroom. They stepped out of the mist. There was no familiar bedroom. The house was gone, and with it, the night. Daylight. Daytime on a countryside where the grass was blue as Brown had never seen it, and where trees were slender, unbranched needles reaching for an orange sky. A sky in which Brown could see 3 gigantic suns. The big man ripped free, swore, spun back to face the mist. The little man shook his head.
We just made it, Brown. The mist is gone.
The little man was changing. He seemed to grow, fill out his clothes.
I'm sorry, Brown. I couldn't get through except with the ring or with someone wearing the ring. That meant it had to be you.
This is crazy. Where...
The big man stopped, looked again at the suns. He rubbed his forehead.
Home. My home. Find another mist while you wear the ring, and then go home. To your home.
But a mist? Yeah, you'll hear rumors, wild tales. We have stories of ghosts here, too. Be an investigator. Track down those rumors.
But...
Good luck, Brown.
The little man turned quickly, began walking across the strange blue grass. Once he looked back, saw Brown staring helplessly after him. He hesitated for an instant, then hurried on. In a moment, he was among the needle trees, then out of Brown's sight. That story was The Mist by Peter Carter. Copyright 1952 by Fantasy House. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Technical production for this episode of Mindwebs by Darkman. This is a special production of MindWebs by WMSE 91.7 FM, Milwaukee.